Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we get to talk with former Chief Medical Director at Bellevue Hospital in New York City, Dr. Eric Mannheimer, about the medical response to Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah, Christy, this is an article that he had in the New England Journal of Medicine recently about the disaster and the challenges that he faced personally, patients faced, and staff faced. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
I am too. But first, we have research that matters. I don't think we're going to be talking about my scratchy voice and my cold today, but I do have to fess up that I'm a little under the weather.
Well, we are. We do hope you feel better. We absolutely do. But if you thought you might need an EGD, an esophagastroduodenostomy
for my throat
procedure for your throat, we have some research that might be appropriate, and whether or not you think taking omega-6 fatty acids could lower your risk of heart failure, we can address that too.
And about brain changes, possibly making elderly people more prone to scams.
And finally, if a parent dies to cancer or a traumatic death, is the child at risk for inflicting self-trauma to themselves? Really important. But let's start, Christy, about this research about patients getting what's called an EGD, where they look under a scope passing down through the mouth into the esophagus to see for serious changes in the esophagus, like esophageal cancer. Are there being too many done in the United States?
Well, and a group of U.S. internal medicine doctors recently came out with a stronger recommendation suggesting that we limit these endoscopes or EGD tests to screen people for cancer as sort of a routine process for people who have heartburn.
And this article in the Annals of Internal Medicine would suggest that this procedure is probably being done perhaps a little too quickly and a little too much. So, for instance, if you have symptoms of heart reflux, of acid, you don't need to have this procedure. Matter of fact, probably shouldn't have the procedure because there are complications. Even though they're not frequent, there are complications.
There are. I had a patient just last week who was asking for one of these due to pretty straightforward heartburn and had this conversation with her about trying the treatment first. And this will be good and helpful information for me to relay to my patient as well, that this supports what we decided, which is to not do that EGD test for something that we can treat and is pretty classic.
Even some people out there may have heard of something called Barrett's esophagus, probably named after Dr. Barrett, my guess is,
mm-hmm.
but where people have higher risk for developing cancer of the esophagus. And even among those people, these recommendations suggest we're doing it too often and shouldn't be done yearly, but maybe every 3 years. But you want to reduce your risk of esophageal cancer, we know what you need to do. You need to quit smoking and cut back on drinking if you drink too much. Those are the common sense things.
Let's talk about older people being more prone to scams. This reminds me of a lovely couple of my patients who lost a lot of money due to someone preying on them, just calling them up on the phone and talking them into something that wasn't real, and it took their money. This happens really commonly.
Yes, and it seems to be older people who are targeted by scammers. And this is research, Christy, that was in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, where they asked two different studies, but they asked a group of 120 people who were between the ages of 55 and 84, as well as younger people, to look at stacks of photographs and to see how trustworthy the individuals looked. and whether they were trustworthy or untrustworthy.
And then they looked at MRI tests where they could see which parts of the brain were lighting up as the different groups looked at the pictures. And they found that in the younger study subjects, the brain scans lit up in this certain part of the brain called the anterior insula when they looked at these untrustworthy pictures. But for the older persons, their brains did not light up in that area as much.
And when they rated the pictures that were trustworthy, the younger and older people said that they rated them all more likely the same. But when they viewed faces that were untrustworthy, the older adults were less likely to pick up on the cues. So both the pictures and the scans would seem to indicate that there are some changes that older adults may be less likely to either view certain people as untrustworthy or have cues to say, I need to be aware of this. I don't know. What do you think, Christy?
I think that this is just another reminder for us to really look after our loved ones. If you are an older person, to be on guard and just know that you're at higher risk for scammers to really pick you to go after. And don't give your money to anybody on the phone.
Maybe it's older people are nicer.
Maybe that's right.
I don't know, but I think wiser listening more, but healthy skepticism of scam artists. I'm all for that, Christy.
Well, absolutely.
Let's talk about our next research one, which is about after a parent dies, children being more likely to harm themselves. Research in the Archives of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine.
This really hits home as well as my father passed when I was a teenager. So I have a heart for these teens who lost one of their parents to cancer and apparently are more likely to cut or burn themselves compared with teens who have two living parents.
Yes, 20% of the teens with only one surviving parent said they had done something to hurt themselves compared to only 10% of teens. And this goes along with a lot of other data that suggests that losing a parent is traumatic. And I know it had to have been traumatic for you as well, Christy. And I guess the question is, what helped you? What was the support you got that really helped you be a leading physician in the community and in the United States?
Well, I was very fortunate and blessed to have a loving family and support system in our community. And so not everybody has, is afforded that much support the way people really rallied for our family. I do think open communication, I had a mom who really was there to talk openly. And so if you have a child who's lost one of their parents or you know someone going through a hard time, that open communication and potentially getting some counseling for a child who's going through that grieving process is very important.
Amen, Christy. Amen to that. And speaking to our last research that matters, it's just a very simple research, but one that has implications for lots of our listeners about these omega fats, omega-6 fats, and people who maybe take them as supplements. And is there any benefit really to the heart, in this case, preventing heart failure?
So there is some benefit or some link in the research to taking these omega-6 fats and having a slightly lower blood pressure, and also some evidence to say that people who eat a lot of fish and get omega-3 fatty acids might have a lower risk of heart failure. So this was to see if you took the supplements, would that over time reduce your risk of heart failure?
And in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, they published this research, which was done on 22,000 male physicians. It probably means me. why do they leave out women physicians, Christy? I don't know. It's not fair. But on this particular case, there was no benefit. So over 17 years looking at the risk of heart failure, those who took these supplements had no lower risk of heart failure. So this is about as good of research as you're going to get on this topic. So maybe some other reasons that you might take them, but probably not for this one. Well, that'll conclude our research that matters, Christy. We've had a chance to talk about omega-6 fats and no help for heart failure risk.
About the fact that after parents' cancer death, 1 in 5 children self-injure.
About helping all of us, including our parents and loved ones, avoid scams.
And finally, about the need for us to dial back ordering so many EGDs or screening for esophageal cancer for people who have heartburn.
Well, we'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Eric Manheimer about a medical response to Hurricane Sandy. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with former chief medical director at Bellevue Hospital in New York City, Dr. Eric Mannheimer, about a medical response to Hurricane Sandy. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Mannheimer.
Hi, Adam and Christy. Delighted to be here today. Thank you very much.
We're glad to have you with us. You know, I know if we could start, Dr. Mannheimer, to share with us a bit of what led you to write this article. You certainly have an important perspective, having been a medical director at Bellevue. And we want to touch on your article in the New England Journal of Medicine about that medical response to Hurricane Sandy. But what led you to write it?
What led me to write it is several things. One is I had been at Bellevue for 15 years, going into 15 and a half years. I've had a long experience there. I came there in 1997 from a previous job at Dartmouth Medical School, where I was there for 17 years. But being at Bellevue gave me a unique opportunity, and it gives me a unique opportunity to see things from a citywide perspective, because mm-hmm. it's the largest public hospital. It's also the oldest hospital in the country. It sits right on the East River, just south of the UN, and it's part of the biggest public hospital system in the country. There's 11 hospitals tied together in this big, gigantic system that's sitting around New York. It gives you a view of the city and public health in New York and the vulnerable groups in New York. And one of the most striking things to me was we had a hurricane that came, and clearly it was a lot bigger than people had anticipated, and it hit the city with full force. And Bellevue was just one area that was affected, but it had implications. And I thought it would be really helpful to the medical audience that reads the New England Journal of Medicine to have some insights into that from my particular vantage point.
Well, I know we're going to want to understand that vantage point a lot more. I'd like to just, though, give us a little bit better picture of you mentioned Bellevue as this hospital and this interconnected group of hospitals in one of the largest urban areas in the country. Give us a sense of how many people are served there. Because I think we think of University of North Carolina hospitals, you know, has 600 beds, but in a town that, you know, 50 to 75,000 people, that's not the case for you.
Well, Bellevue is a 850-bed hospital. It's well known probably to most of your listeners who listen to shows like Law & Order and CSI and things like that as being a psychiatric hospital. And in fact, we do have a very, very large psychiatric number of beds that are specialized within Bellevue. In fact, we have 350 psychiatric beds, making us probably the largest inpatient psychiatric facility in the country. In addition, we have over 500 regular medical surgical beds. I have two grandchildren that were born at Bellevue in our birthing area. We have a very large emergency room and trauma center, and we have everything else. One other thing we have, which your listeners might be interested in, is we have a prison unit. We have 100 beds for prisoners. We take care of the prisoners from Rikers Island, which is actually the largest jail in the United States. It holds 20,000 prisoners.
And you're full probably almost all the time, if not all
the time. We're full, we have over 90% census, you know, most of the time. That's right.
You touch on your article about some of the decisions that go into evacuating a hospital. I would imagine evacuating a hospital that big. I mean, I can't even imagine the complexity of that and the nervousness around making those decisions. Share with us a little bit about the picture that goes into making a decision like that.
Well, I think there's one decision. There's one overwhelming issue, which is just the safety of the patients and the safety of the staff. So everything else is really secondary. And the number one thing you're trying to weigh is how safe is the facility if something bad happens for the patients. The one thing you have to remember, we're a little different in that we are tied into a network of 11 hospitals altogether. So Bellevue is one of 11 public hospitals. And within the greater metropolitan area, there are approximately 75 hospitals. So New York City, greater metropolitan area, has a lot of hospitals. What I meant by the fact that we're part of 11 hospitals, we have a lot of sister hospitals. So if there is a problem at Bellevue, And Bellevue happens to be in the lowest lying area in what they call the most vulnerable area for any hurricane or water issues. We're actually built on landfill that extends into the East River. It's actually called Kipps Bay, and it's really sand and mud and stone.
So when you're thinking about, as a medical director, of a natural disaster like this, you have contingency plans? Can you practice for this type of just disaster that would shut down a whole hospital?
We practice it all the time. In fact, the way hospitals in New York City have prepared changed completely after 9/11. So 9/11 is definitely the turning point when disasters, primarily around what might be perceived as terrorist events, really moved up to the center stage, particularly over, say, the last half a dozen years. So we do simulations all the time, citywide, in fact, and then locally, and prepare to evacuate the hospital for a whole variety of different reasons.
And so what happened? When, as far as you know, the when did you think that the leadership knew that this was the worst case scenario was happening?
Well, let me just say there are two issues here. One is there's a local issue, which might just involve your hospital where you have to do an evacuation. So let's say there's something that happens within the area. There might be an explosion or something, and you have to evacuate the hospital. That's just involving your own facility. With an event like this, this is really managed not just locally, but it's actually superseded by the Department of Health of New York City and New York State run an emergency command center. They run it in New York City, but they're getting feeds from the city, the state, and the federal government, the military, all kinds of agencies about what the likelihood of the storm hitting, what the surge would be, and other issues. And they're the ones actually calling the shots about evacuation or not evacuation.
So you have to have this incredible communications network that's probably more sophisticated than most people would realize.
Yes and no. The issue was, you know, we had always depended upon cell phone service, even if things really, if there was significant damage. And one of the complicating factors was that cell phone service went out largely, not completely, but it went out through several of the big carriers in the city within the Bellevue area. Everything below 34th Street went out. The transformer that supplied that area was on 14th Street, and it blew, short-circuited essentially, and blew out a lot of the cell phone service. So we weren't completely isolated, but our phone service was off. We had some walkie-talkie, and we did have limited cell phone service.
So as we begin, we're talking with Dr. Eric Mannheimer about a medical response to Hurricane Sandy in Bellevue and the hospital system in New York City. Give us a sense of the first 5 or 10 things, the types of decisions once you know that you've got such a serious situation, and really what types of situations developed.
Well, the first things you're thinking about is, with this, we knew that a storm was coming, so we were prepared for a hurricane. The issue was going to be, so what we do is we immediately open our command center. We have an emergency command center, which has extensive telecommunications. We have telephone hookups, and we have designated roles for about 10 people that are sitting around the table responsible for a variety of different functions. And it's a well-devised and widely utilized type of command structure. And they're interchangeable parts. So, if, for example, if I'm not there as the chief medical officer, there's somebody else who can take my place. And we rehearse those roles over many, many simulated events over many years. So that immediately gets activated several days before the storm actually hits. So approximately 72 hours ahead, we activate at a low level, then we gradually augment it. In addition, what we do at that time is we make sure that we have enough food in the hospital for several days, usually a week. We make sure we have enough water, bottled water, and we have enough medication for patients and other things just to ensure that should we be cut off, should there be not able to be supplied, we're generally supplied every single day for these different things that we can sort of hold out. The other issue is we prepare our emergency generators and make sure that we have enough fuel for them, we test them, et cetera, et cetera. So things like that are all done in anticipation of the storm hitting.
We're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, Dr. Mannheimer, I think we want to pick up on this thought of what really were the most challenging things for patients, staff, and for you yourself. So we'll take a short break, but we'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with former Chief Medical Director at Bellevue Hospital in New York City, Dr. Eric Mannheimer, about a medical response to Hurricane Sandy. And Dr. Mannheimer, right before we took a break, you had started to talk about the kind of the challenges, and you talked about that you really want to provide for both patients and staff. What were the great challenges both from a staff perspective and a patient perspective in this type of major disaster?
Well, I think, you know, our staff is very energized around problems. I mean, we are a hospital that you might say thrives on acute issues. So our staff is really used to it and are very, very responsive. And we get excellent turnout. We have approximately 5,000 people that work at the hospital, plus we have 1,000 physicians. So you're talking about 6,000 people. We have a lot of residents. We have we have a combined residency with NYU and the VA, so we have about 1,200 residents. So it's a big, busy place.
But they have their own families. They have their own environments, right? This affected everyone, right?
It did, but it affected everybody. So the thing we're concerned about the most is, you know, can they stay in touch with their families? Are there vulnerable people that they need to be with? Can they make arrangements to stay in the hospital if they get cut off and can't get back there? The thing about a hurricane is that makes this difference than other kind of events. So, for example, if there's an explosion in New York and suddenly you're isolated and cut off, that's what it is. We could see this coming. So we had, you know, 72 hours to really make sure that we had all the staff we needed in the hospital when the hurricane hit, and people could make arrangements with their families and say, you know, make sure that they had enough food and they had enough, you know, flashlights and things like that, and then choose to stay in the hospital. So that all can be planned in advance. The big issue, the big defining issue for us and for Langone Medical Center and the VA, which is just a couple blocks south from us. So there's three hospitals on First Avenue, all affected by the transformer blowing. We all lost power. And then everybody went on emergency backup power. The problem was the generators were above the water line, but the pumps weren't, the pumps that pumped the gasoline to the generators. So they all lost generator power. And when that happened, then it is an acute
crisis,
and everybody's vulnerable.
You tell a story in your article about the staff's real dedication to patients. Some patients transferring a hospital certainly wouldn't be as challenging as others. And you tell the story of a heart patient in the ICU. Share that with our listeners. I think that really highlights some of the complexity.
Well, in a hospital of our size, you know, when you're talking about at that point when power went down, we had 700 patients in the hospital. And I think you're absolutely right, Christy. Some of the patients can walk. Some of the patients you can get down and put in almost taxis with another individual and get them to another facility. Others require ambulances, et cetera. But within that 700 patients, you're going to have some very, very sick, critically ill patients. Those are usually in our intensive care units. And there was one patient that you asked about. He was in he was a cardiac patient who had a heart attack and had a very, very poorly functioning heart. His heart was only squeezing a very small amount of blood out, and we needed to put him on a special device that was a heart assist device, like a little extra pump that would assist his heart in pushing blood out to perfuse his brain and the rest of his body. And the question was, you know, how long could we keep this going? Because this is basically a device that uses a battery. So we had to ensure that we had enough electricity to keep that going, because if that failed, then he would die immediately. And then in addition, he needed some additional surgery. So what this guy was became the focus of our cardiac team, and we have a very excellent cardiac team, but they had to stay with him for several days round the clock, somebody with very tremendous amount of experience, both nursing and physician, to keep him alive, and we had to keep an electrical source going. So that had to be that required a tremendous amount of individual effort from a lot of people just to focus on one patient.
Well, and I'm sure that was also true for the youngest patients that you had in the hospital as well that were quite sick.
The thing about, you're absolutely right, the thing about the neonatal intensive care unit was that there are many, many other neonatal units around town, and what you can do is you can get two or three people can take a little baby in an incubator on batteries and get them in an ambulance and then get them to one of these other facilities in, you know, anywhere between 15 minutes and 45 minutes. So we're doing this all the time with the little kids because they're tiny. The incubators fit in ambulances. They get tied down. And we're always transferring patients between hospitals. Places are sending their little babies to us. We're sending our babies to, say, Columbia Presbyterian because they do ECMO and other kind of specialty treatments. So that was a problem, but we had 23 neonates, and of the 23, there are five that were acutely ill. So you just get all the ambulances there, get them lined up, and get babies out of there in an hour.
That's amazing. So
it seems, yes, they are vulnerable, but it wasn't as treacherous as it might seem.
Now, was traffic, I'm trying to picture getting all these people through traffic during a time of crisis and emergency. Do people clear the way?
There's no traffic. What had happened was over the hurricane is coming at 5 miles an hour slowly off the coast, and the city quieted down. It starts to get windy. It got extremely quiet. Nobody is on the roads. Nobody is out except the police and a few people driving the cars, but very, very limited traffic. So when the hurricane, as it accelerated and started to hit the city, there's virtually nobody out there. And in fact, the city then shut down the subway system and virtually nobody is moving. So what we do is you get National Guard is there. You'll get sort of a police escort, National Guard escort with the ambulances to assist in getting to where you have to go. But by the time the hurricane hit, everybody is shut down in their apartment, in their house, and nobody's budging.
Well, you've talked about kind of the poignancy and the charging to take care, and you have this incredible responsibilities for staff and patients, but you also had your own personal stories and involvement. And I have family, a mother and family, other family that lives up there that was without power for a week and had to go into a hospital setting for some of them, and that was there for them. But what about for you personally? Because you also are a victim of the hurricane.
Yeah, absolutely. I live near Bellevue, and I live in Greenwich Village. I can walk to work, which I do. It's a 20-minute walk, 25-minute walk back and forth. My own apartment house, I was the night of the storm hit in full intensity and blew the transformer. I was at home with my wife, and we were watching the news, and everything went out immediately. The power went out, and we looked out the windows, and we could see the power going out below the Empire State Building, which is on 34th Street. Every few blocks, you could see it every 2 minutes it went, and then it went, and then it went, and it went from the East River to the Hudson River, all the way down to Battery Park, was completely pitch black. And then we tried to call some friends, and our cell phone service was out as well. So we knew it was a very bad electrical issue. And I live on the 23rd floor, so that was also a bit of a stress situation for us. We ended up being able to stay in our apartment for a few days, but after a few days, we moved to my son's place, who lives in Brooklyn, on between the Brooklyn-Queens border, and it was electricity was functioning in that area. The problem was, at that point, gasoline was running on very short supply in the city, and It was very hard to get around, and there were six-hour lines in front of the few gas stations that had any gas. So it became, even at that point, an issue for people to get around. Nobody could get to work, get back to work. The bridges and tunnels were shut down in the city, so nobody was going anyplace.
Well, it sounds like this was a tremendous experience, both for you and for your patients, and we appreciate you taking time to share it with us. You titled your article "Seeing in the Dark," and I wonder, you know, what do you think is the take-home message as you reflect on your impression of this experience?
I think there were two major issues. I called it "Seeing in the Dark" because there was something about when everything got shut down, and you had to make decisions, and you had to see that these decisions were being made, it's almost like you could see better in the dark. And one of the things, there were two major issues for me. One, relating directly to the evacuation of the patients. The decision was made by the authorities to not evacuate before the storm hit. And the information, the feeds that they were getting said that the storm wouldn't be as severe, that it would be more like Hurricane Irene from last year. And clearly that was an error. So the question is and remains was it the right decision to make? And that'll be gone over and thought by many, many people for some time. The second issue, and I think this is actually probably even more important, we had just gone through an election, presidential election campaign, and hadn't heard one word about climate change. Not one word throughout an entire election campaign. And Mayor Bloomberg changed his endorsement and shifted it to Obama, a Democrat, based on the fact that the Democrats have been talking about, at least in some format, talking about climate change. And that, to me, this was a very, very profound issue, that we have a hurricane of monumental proportions in the greater metropolitan area of New York, and finally, the most senior people politically in the country are able to talk about what may turn out to be one of the most profound issues that's going to affect the entire globe in the next 10 to 15 years.
Well, we want to thank our guest today, former chief medical director at Bellevue Hospital in New York City, Dr. Eric Mannheimer, about sharing with us your reflections, your essay, your experiences, and putting this in context about Hurricane Sandy, which is a lifetime experience that none of us hope to have. But thank goodness there are leaders like you and others in New York City that saved thousands of lives.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me. I was delighted to talk to you, Christy and Adam. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Mannheimer.
Okay.
Coming up on
House Calls.
Thank you. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
Please send us comments or questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, let's just jump right in and listen to our very first House Call question about really high blood pressure.
I was told at my doctor visit recently that I have high blood pressure. They said it was 210 over 110, and it was the same when I came in 2 days later for a recheck. I'm healthy, have no symptoms at all, and I'm just 28 years old. I've started exercising regularly, and I'm trying to lose weight. My doctor insists that I should start medication, but I am uncertain, particularly because I don't want to be on medication for the rest of my life. What do you think?
That is very high. 210 over 110 is very, very high. And the fact that you're so young with it that high is concerning to me.
Yeah, we call things mild, moderate, and severe. We don't get too worried about mild, moderate, severe. We get kind of worried, and that's severe. So that's probably why your doctor's worried, and that's why Christy and I are worried.
So I would agree with your doctor that starting medication to bring that down while the doctor's working with you to try to sort out why your blood pressure is that high at that young of an age would be important.
we congratulate you on trying to be healthier and losing weight and exercising and probably watching your diet and salt intake. And are you going to be on this medication for the rest of your life? Well, Christy and I might have different answers about that, but probably, maybe, possibly. But we have to worry about right now.
Sure. Right now, I would get that blood pressure down and take that medication. And I think if you are severely overweight, then losing significant weight and doing those things can really make a difference in your life and your long-term picture. If there's another reason that your blood pressure is so high, figuring that out, and then, you know, it's possible that there's a cause that could be fixed that maybe won't be long-term.
High blood pressure used to be called the silent killer. You heard of that, Christy?
I sure have.
Yep. It was teaches to us in medical school, and so we don't want it to kill you when you aren't aware. You now know it. We hope you work with your doctor to get it treated. Thank you for your question. Let's listen to our very next house call.
I have a neurological condition called Tourette's. It is pretty bad, and I wanted to know if there are any new medications I can take to control it so that I do not embarrass myself in public and at work.
Tourette's. Well, I don't know if we've ever had a question about Tourette's.
I don't think we have. We should
probably kind of say what this is, because not all our listeners would know what Tourette's is.
So people who have Tourette's will often have these what we call tics, where you might have involuntarily, where you're not even trying to move your muscle, move your hand a certain way, or say certain words. Sometimes it's repetitive.
And sometimes a lot of the behaviors are, you might say, an obscene word or an obscene phrase that people like, you shouldn't say that in public. And yet this happens a lot of times as children, as they're, you know, young children will develop this, and it's called Tourette's syndrome.
And the good news is there are medicines that you can take that can control it. They're not all perfect, and you have to think about side effects and cost, but there are medicines that can make a real difference.
Certainly, if you're having impacts at work or in public, that's one of the reasons to probably take medicine, because it really is impacting you. And there are some of these newer medicines, we call them phenothiazines, or kind of atypical medications that are sometimes used to treat people with psychoses or schizophrenia or really bad conditions, but they work sometimes for this condition as well.
There are other medicines like an SSRI or the medicine for depression that sometimes can make a difference. And other things like Requip, which you see a lot of times on
TV. Restless legs, but also could work to prevent these kind of tics. And one that I love to hear more about, but it's something called habit reversal training, Christy. HRT, a new behavioral therapy that can help maybe improve these tics and control the symptoms of Tourette syndrome.
Well, that would be ideal if there's a way to train yourself not to do it without needing medication. But usually it could be a combination of the two to make a difference. We certainly wish you the best. Let's take our next house call about smoking.
My mother smokes a pack a day, but she also has schizophrenia. What medication is best to help her with her smoking cessation?
Well, we assume it's cigarettes she's smoking.
That's true. And congratulations to her for wanting to quit, I hope, to stop smoking, because that is, you know, a really important decision for her life.
And we shouldn't assume that just because people have schizophrenia that they don't want to quit smoking. Still, a majority of people do want to quit smoking with schizophrenia, but it's harder because they tend to smoke more, be more heavily nicotine dependent, and may need more help both pharmacologically with medications, but also with support from a therapist.
So there is a new medication, and the trade name is Chantix, and the generic name is?
Varenicline.
That is commonly used and effective to help people stop smoking. And apparently there is a trial that's been done in the setting of schizophrenia.
Yes, and it showed that it was effective. And as with anything, there are side effects of the medication. The doctor would talk with you about that. So that's one option. In addition, sometimes people, you combine a couple different types of nicotine replacement therapy, particularly with someone like this. This is an important topic. We thank you for raising it, and we wish you lots of luck.
Let's hear our very next house call question about diabetes.
I was recently diagnosed with diabetes and was 60 pounds overweight. I have lost 20 pounds in the last 3 months, and I am surprised that this weight loss has not cured my diabetes. Will that happen?
Well, first off, congratulations. Losing weight and losing 20 pounds. Hopefully you've done that as a result of the diagnosis and a desire to lose weight. That's great.
Yes. Congratulations to you on that. You know, it is true that diabetes is weight related and that your overall picture of health is you're going to be better off by losing the weight. But to think it would cure it with 20 pounds, I guess there's some people that might tip them back into the just elevated but not diabetes range. But for most people, it requires significant weight loss to get those numbers down. And it's really a process and a spectrum and not so much a black and white, you have it or you don't. Maybe you can explain this a little.
I'm not sure I can explain it better. But if I were a betting man, which I'm not because I lose most times, I would bet, though, if you lost 60 pounds, if you were 60 pounds overweight, you probably wouldn't be diabetic
especially
anymore.
Especially if it was mild to begin with.
Yeah. So keep on the path that you're doing and let us know. Give us an update. Well, Christy, that'll conclude our house calls. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today. We hope we've addressed issues that are important. And they can – any of our listeners can follow us at our yourhealthradio.org or download our health app.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Eric Mannheimer. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.